This is Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Join me now for the concluding segment in a series of four programs for Black History Month 1993. My guest is poet and literary critic D.L. Crockett Smith.
Bessie Smith becomes legend. On the night the Empress died, crushed in Mississippi dark, the cold moon moaned a blue chord. A Ford plowed down the wrong side of the road, the driver drunk. On that night, the Empress died.
D.L. Crockett Smith, reading from his poem, Bessie Smith Becomes Legend. In just a moment, you'll hear the poem in its entirety. Later on the show, Smith will read and discuss another of his poems, one called Poetic Justice Thomas. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. D.L. Crockett Smith is a poet and literary critic who teaches at Williams College. Among his concerns as a poet is the interplay of race and identity, both cultural and individual. He asks how that interplay affects the construction of racial myth and stereotype. One of his poems, for example, is about Bessie Smith, the blues singer. It's called Bessie Smith Becomes Legend.
On the night the Empress died, crushed in Mississippi dark, the cold moon moaned a blue chord. A Ford plowed down the wrong side of the road, the driver drunk. On that night, the Empress died. Even Bessie must have cried a pain shrill operatic, but the moon moaned a blue chord. White men, we say, let her bleed. They sought a Jim Crow clinic on the night the Empress died. In truth, they gave their best aid. Still, we blame them, not the wreck, and the cold moon moans a blue chord. We made death for our black bard mythic to match her music. On the night the Empress died, the cold moon moaned a blue chord.
D.L. Crockett Smith, the poem is Bessie Smith Becomes Legend. I got to come clean and tell you, the first thing I thought of here was Don McLean in American Pie. That is to say, the loss of a figure that is there on our popular horizon. And we're saying to ourselves, what do we do now? Am I right? Am I trivializing your poem?
No, that's one aspect of what it's about, the tragedy of her death. But the other part is my fascination with the myth around her death, which has been perpetuated by Edward Albee's play dealing with her, the death of Bessie Smith, which claims that her death was because of racism, which isn't actually true. But that myth has had more force than the actual facts of the case. In a paradoxical sense, the myth is more true than the facts.
So what you want to do here is explore and perpetuate, not explode the myth, but you want the myth to stand on its own terms. You don't want it to be is there such a thing as a false myth?
The myth tells us something about ourselves. That's always true of any story that can acquire the status of myth. I mean, it's being a myth means that it is meaningful and persuasive to a large number of people in the culture.
It's also subject to a lot of different interpretations.
That's right. That's right. It has a kind of emotional force, which is what holds it in place, but it's got a certain ambiguity about it. And in this case, the facts are that Bessie Smith was hit by a car. Her car had stopped because they were having mechanical problems. And she was out on the highway, and somebody came along who didn't see her, and she was hit. And
not because she was a black woman.
No, it was just an accident, and she was gravely injured. And a doctor, a white doctor, just happened upon the scene, and so she got probably better care than 99% of people on an accident scene. And she was sent directly to a hospital when the ambulance came, but she died, and the story got out that she had been sent to a segregated hospital and died because of racism. It's just not true.
Why should we call Bessie Smith an empress in our culture?
Well, that was the nickname that she was given, and one of the reasons is because she was crucial in popularizing the blues as a form. Her recordings and performances were so popular. She was the leading figure in the music during her time. She especially was the one who helped to bring it to white audiences. So, you know, she was perhaps more than anybody else responsible for making the blues a popular form in America across the racial line.
Do we remember her, and do you, D.L. Crockett Smith, remember Bessie Smith in this poem because you are valorizing her and exalting her for a black audience or for an audience, that is to say, black as well as white people?
Well, the latter. I think that we as Americans have to embrace all of our history and all of our culture. And one of our profound problems, especially the problem that comes with racial identity, is that sometimes we want to use that as a way of making our thinking exclusive, mm-hmm. and to think because this figure is black, she is for black people. No, she's an American figure, and of course she has a particular meaning within the black community, but all Americans should be interested in her for what her music tells us about our culture and for its emotional power to move anybody who really listens to it.
How did you create this poem, D.L. Crockett Smith? I speak to you as D.L. Crockett Smith, the poet. There is also David Smith, the English professor, standing somewhere at this microphone.
That's right. This poem, it's a villanelle, which is one of the most difficult forms to write in English. It's a French form, highly structured, and the first and third line of the poems repeat. They become the last line of each succeeding stanza, and then they become the last two lines of the poem.
Give me the first couple of stanzas.
On the night the empress died is the first line.
Uh-huh.
The third line is the cold moon moaned a blue chord. Those two lines repeat with slight variations throughout the poem.
Indeed.
And then they become a couplet at the end of the poem. And I like to write villanelles.
Was it difficult to write? I mean, did you pick the form?
It's very hard, yeah. I like to write them for the technical challenge because I find it very productive to play with the tension between a demanding technical form and the appearance of freedom. So I think it doesn't necessarily sound as rigidly structured as it is. I hope it doesn't sound as rigidly structured as it is to a listener, but the discipline is there. And I think that any poet, poetry is about the crafting of language.
Uh-huh.
And one has to be ambitious and to set high standards for oneself technically. It's not just an attempt to convey a certain content, but to have a mastery over the form in which it's conveyed. And to me, the villanelle is a kind of blues form because, like the classic blues, it's got a basically three-line structure with repetition, heavy repetition. In the classic blues, it's AAB. The first line repeats, and then there's a third line.
Is this meant to be sung? Should we hear this in our heads, as it were, with a musical rendition?
I want it to have a song-like quality. You know, it's not, there's no music for it, but I want it to be like music, and especially like the blues.
Now, a moment ago, D.L. Crockett Smith, you used a phrase, I can't repeat it exactly, but it struck me that you were talking about the tension between the freedom and, on the other side, the discipline that goes into the making of a poem like this. That could be emblematic of the entire problem of our race relations in this country. That is to say, we have got structures that we've got to live within, and yet we want to recognize the freedom and the initiative of individual people. Am I bringing to this on the spot, an intention that you didn't have in mind when you wrote this poem?
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't quite thought of that in connection to the crafting of this poem, but I think you're right that is a fundamental problem. And it's not just a problem in a way that weakens us, but it's an enabling factor also. That tension is a creative tension, and I think that we would be well served to recognize that that's the nature of our history. History brings to us things that are enabling and things that are disabling.
Right.
And we, no matter what we do, we can't eliminate that tension. What we can do is to try to use it productively and to recognize what the character of those inheritances is, so that we don't simply keep repeating mistakes from the past, that we try to move forward, but recognize that our inheritance is a mixed one, and it's always going to be mixed. No matter how hard we try to be simply good, we will always fail. That's the story of all of our great classical myths. It's the story of the Bible.
Absolutely.
It's human limitation. It's the source of art, you know, the struggle between those tendencies, whether you call it freedom and discipline or whether you call it aspiration and limitation.
Right.
It's dealing with that tension is profoundly enabling.
Do I hear a fundamental optimism here, Dale Crockett Smith, the poetic persona speaking to me about race in the United States as you look forward to the future and back to the Empress, Bessie Smith?
Well, yes and no. It's optimistic in the sense that hope is a possibility. I think that hope, the possibility of success, the possibility of change is always present, and to recognize that is hopeful.
Uh-huh.
But there's no guarantee of success. And there is a guarantee.
Can't nail you down on this.
There's a guarantee of death. Uh-huh. You know, so even a transcendent artist like Bessie Smith dies like the rest of us. You know, that's the tragic nature of the human condition. No matter how skilled we are, we can fail. So I want to keep those two insights always in mind, you know, that there is the that there is the certainty of ultimate failure and the possibility of transcendent success.
D.L. Crockett Smith, I want to thank you for your participation on Soundings. You are the poet, D.L. Crockett Smith. You are also David Smith, the English professor at Williams College. You've just wrapped up a year here at our Humanities Center. Your poem is Bessie Smith Becomes Legend. Thanks for coming by. Good luck in your work.
Thank you. My pleasure.
After you go and let me cry, after you go, there's no denying. You'll feel blue, you'll feel sad, you'll miss the dearest help you ever had. There'll come a time, now don't forget it, there'll come a time.
This is Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You're listening to the concluding segment in a series of four programs for Black History Month 1993. My guest is the poet and literary critic D.L. Crockett Smith.
Poetic Justice Thomas. Marshall steps down, and Love Child auditions for the Supremes. Don't you know what's going on? A White House black man, civil, right, black justice for black times. Who is this doubtful Thomas? He licks out his grandpa's tongue. Judge
D.L. Crockett Smith, reading from his poem, Poetic Justice Thomas. You'll hear the poem in its entirety in just a moment. D.L. Crockett Smith follows the cultural interplay between conceptions of race and the ways we understand social myths and stereotypes. That interplay underscores his poem, Poetic Justice Thomas, an artistic rendition of the Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas episode that recently punctuated American politics. I asked D.L. Crockett Smith to read and talk about his poem.
Poetic Justice Thomas. Marshall steps down, and Love Child auditions for the Supremes. Don't you know what's going on? A White House black man, civil, right, black justice for black times. Who is this doubtful Thomas? He licks out his grandpa's tongue. Judge gets high on civil rights. let a bitch bark, judge gets down. Reborn, he tries his jury. He shakes his prickly pinpoint crown, bloody in their faces, bleeding the women's bodies. How these pilots wash their hands. Boss Bush cries, here come the judge.
D.L. Crockett Smith, I gotta hand it to you. If you wanted to write an inflammatory poem, you have succeeded. Let's begin with the allusions in this poem. In the first stanza, for instance, I hear Marvin Gaye. What's going on?
Yeah, certainly. Motown music, the poem is meant to inflame and amuse and I hope also to provoke thought. Allusion is very important to my poetic technique because I think that that's how the poet is able to ground the work in the shared culture, to give any reader or listener something that they can have an emotional link with, and the link is through the music or the aspect of culture that that I know and that they also know. And I'm trying to show how those elements of culture might have some pertinence to what's being discussed in this case being the Clarence Thomas hearings.
Uh-huh. What about this line, Doubtful Thomas? I take it that, well, we got a contradiction here. Here you are, a black poet, and you're going after our only black Supreme Court justice?
Well, I don't think that needs to be a contradiction. I think we have to have the ability to be open-minded and criticize and disagree within the black community, as with any community, as within any community, if it's going to have intellectual integrity and moral integrity. You have to be able to say, I approve, I disapprove, this is right, this is not right. And part of what's here is just reporting in my own way the elements of what happened, you know, Thomas's invocation of his grandfather and trying to invoke some of the issues such as the abortion question that people identified as being very much at stake with his candidacy. I, of course, have my own view on those political issues, and I think that's clear from the poem, but I tried to raise it in a way that is questioning and open-minded, not simply declarative. And the other thing I would say about the composition is that the poem sort of took off as I thought of the Supreme Court as the Supremes. And that led me to thinking about Motown music,
right,
to the song Love Child, which has some of the kinds of same kinds of themes that Thomas talks about in as he presented his life story. And so I just turn it around. When it's the Supremes singing it, it's a different sounding story. And the question of abortion is there in the background. That's what's happening here.
Yeah, new meaning to the word lamentation.
Yeah, and it's rethinking these very popular cultural artifacts.
Is there nothing positive that you have to say about Justice Thomas and about not so much the man himself? Although I understand you, there's a great burden here in your criticism upon Justice Thomas, but about the process, the conditions that produced this national spectacle that we went through. Do you have anything positive to say about that?
Well, I'm not sure how I would define positive in this context. What I'm trying to capture here is the kind of emotion that was invested in this spectacle, this drama. It was tremendously passionate, and so I want to capture the sharpness of the emotion.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a poem that's sympathetic to Justice Thomas, but it is a poem that tries to take seriously the issues that were being invoked and to invest them in this representation with emotional force.
Well, now, when did you make up your mind as a poet, D.L. Crockett Smith, that this poem would take the turns that it has taken? I mean, the testimony of Anita Hill, the behavior of the senators who did the questioning, the responses of the candidate, the nominee, that is, what happened?
I wish I could say it that simply, but really the poem emerges out of the process of its own writing. I just described how Motown got into the poem when I thought of Supreme Court. and that gave me one line of material to work with here. There's biblical allusion here. I refer to the committee as pilots.
Mm-hmm. And Thomas himself becomes a sort of reversed Christ figure.
And that's the way he presented himself, as the persecuted figure.
Yeah.
So I'm playing with that, but it's a serious kind of play. And I don't remember at what point in the process I discovered that possibility, you know, the pilot image, which brings so much of a story with it. And we all know that story, you see. That's what makes it emotionally powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And the order in which the poem appears is not necessarily the order in which it was written. You know, a poet works on material
and
sometimes for a long time, and you throw out stuff. You think you know what you're going to write when you begin, but what you know is that's not a poem. You know, what you start with isn't a poem. And it becomes a poem through the process of really working with the material and fashioning it and seeing what kind of sparks strike as you bring things together. And poetry is best when it surprises you, when you discover things there that you didn't know. Sometimes you discover things that really shock you, that you have some opinions that you weren't admitting to yourself.
And what about this last line? Boss Bush cries, Here comes the judge. Now that takes us back to Laugh-In. It takes us to a number of our black comics.
And yes, I'm trying to invoke the image of the plantation and the house servant. That's part of it. I'm trying to invoke the minstrel show. This line comes from a famous Pigmeat Markham routine back in the vaudeville days. I think he created this sketch, Here Comes the Judge, back in 1929. It was revived by Sammy Davis Jr. on Laugh-In in the 60s. And it's a kind of, well, it's minstrel humor. I want that to be here too. It's a comment on my view of the cast that the hearings took.
Well, now let's talk about the notion of stereotypes and stereotypical thinking. I asked you earlier, you know, because you're a black poet, aren't you in effect betraying the cause? And you said, now wait a minute, let's not talk about this or any other issue monolithically. What is your responsibility, not necessarily as a black poet, but as a poet, to get to the political issues that find their way onto the front pages of our newspapers?
Well, I think that as a poet, my most fundamental responsibility is to try to be true to the material. And I hope that regardless of
or to yourself. I mean, you know, these are, after all, your opinions.
Well, but I'm not making a distinction between that. I'm the one who's working with the material and the process. I mean, that the poetry is in that process of myself as a subject working with a subject matter. Working with some material and
trying to make something. You're the subject of this poem, or Thomas?
So I'm the maker of the poem, but it's my sensibility that selects what's going into it, that gives it a particular spin.
Is it possible, D.L. Crockett Smith, to write about an issue as volatile as this apolitically? Poetry, as it were, exists, you know, in this aesthetic realm in our minds. And yet the catchphrase, what, since the 60s at least, has been that teaching, creativity, they're always inherently political. Do they go hand in hand, necessarily?
Well, I would say that the American poetry establishment does not agree with that consensus you've just described. I mean, I think that most American poets are deeply committed to a very subjectivist concept of aesthetics, so that the work is an expression of the soul, the mind, the individuality.
And if the politics is a byproduct of that, then so be it.
I think most American poets have simply turned their back on not only politics, but on the realm of common culture, because they see...
But now wait. You draw on common culture in this poem. And
I could
say, Don Juan, let's put your back to the wall here, and I want you to admit that you're trying to change the common culture.
Yes, but I'm a dissident. I'm saying that the mainstream of American poetry has rejected that and turned to subjectivity. And I think that they have betrayed one of the deepest callings of our art, because poetry ought to be a communal art. It should want to speak to as large a public as possible and not simply be esoteric. So I'm trying to do that, to speak to things that are out in public. Of course it's personal, it's mine, and I'm not backing down from having my point of view. I'm not going to apologize and try to make it polite. But
it's not that.
But I am trying to be honest and to say there are reasons. You know, the minstrel show image is there because the hearings were framed as a kind of drama. Judge Thomas himself brought in these images of lynching and other aspects of a very familiar popular culture that talked about himself as a black man. So I'm taking another one and throwing it right back at him, which I think is perfectly fair.
D.L. Crockett Smith, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You are also David Smith, the English professor from Williams College. One of your books is Cowboy Amuck, Poems by D.L. Crockett Smith, the Black Scholar Press. You've been working on a project here at our Humanities Center, thinking about writing about race. Thanks for coming by. Good luck in your work.
Thank you.
You think that I don't feel love, but what I feel for you is real love. In others' eyes I see reflected, I heard scorned, rejected love child. Never meant to be.
This is Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. You've been listening to the concluding segment in a series of four programs for Black History Month 1993. My guest was D.L. Crockett Smith, a poet and literary critic who teaches at Williams College. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 648. That's program number 648, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, a distinguished historian reflects on the American presidency over the last 60 years. William Luchtenberg of UNC Chapel Hill will be here to discuss the new edition of his book, In the Shadow of FDR. Major funding for this program came from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Thank you for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week, at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Black History Month, the concluding segment in a series of four programs, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for readings and conversation featuring poet and literary critic D.L. Crockett Smith of Williams College. He'll read and talk about two of his poems, Bessie Smith Becomes Legend and Poetic Justice Thomas, an artistic perspective on race and cultural identity, the poetry of D.L. Crockett Smith for Black History Month, this week on Soundings.